Bom dia. Today on our World Cup tour, we arrived, Dominic, at one of the great giants of the World Cup, don't we? Brazil.
Yeah, the greatest giant, I think people would say, Tom.
The giantest giant.
Yeah, absolutely.
But Brazil is also, of course, a country that featured in a four-part special we did a few months back on the history of Portugal. Brazil, of course, was colonized by Portugal. And at one point during the Peninsular War, the entire Portuguese royal family got ferried across from Portugal by the British Navy to Brazil to escape the onslaught of Napoleon's French, and established an empire there. It became the capital of the entire Portuguese empire, and Portugal itself became a kind of colonial backwater. I mean, extraordinary development. And you promised us then, because we were focusing on Portugal, and once Brazil became independent, we rather left Brazil behind. But you promised us that we would do the history of the Brazilian empire. And that, unless I'm much mistaken, is what you have in store for us today.
That's right, Tom.
So it's a kind of spin-off, isn't it, from our Portuguese epic?
It is, really, yes. I mean, Brazilian listeners will be horrified to hear they're a spin-off. They would say Portugal is the spin-off, wouldn't they, Tom? But yes, isn't it an extraordinary thing that everybody, when they think of the World Cup and they think of football, they think of Brazil. Brazil is, I think, the world's fifth largest country. It's seventh largest by population. By far the largest country in Latin America. And yet, its history has so little traction in the British, the European, and I guess the American imagination. We know so little of it. And the real focus today is Brazil's second and last emperor, Pedro II. And we'll come to him in a moment.
So I'm guessing if he's the second emperor, that the first emperor was Pedro the First. Would that be correct?
That's very astute.
Call me Sherlock.
Very astute. Yes. But yeah, so the extraordinary thing about Brazil is that Brazil is the one Latin American country that begins as a monarchy. It is not a republic. So it became independent in 1822. So the Napoleonic Wars are over. And as you described, and as we talked about in our Portugal podcasts, there's been this sort of rising tension between Portugal and Brazil. The Portuguese kind of want their top status back. They want their royal family back. Dom João, who was the king of Portugal, has gone back to Portugal. But the Brazilian elite, I should say, the Europeanized kind of elite, have thrown off the shackles of Portugal and proclaimed independence.
Encouraged by this Portuguese king, right? I mean, he goes and he tells his son, declare independence.
Yes.
Which is very treacherous behavior from a king.
Well, he doesn't want his son and the court in Rio to be subject to this sort of liberal constitutionalism that is all the rage in Portugal. So what happens, it's 1822. Brazil has about 3 million people. It has this, its wealth is based in exploitation, I suppose you would say. It's on gold and sugar, from which the Portuguese have been profiting in the 18th century. It's also largely based on slavery. So Brazil has imported more slaves than anywhere else in the world.
11 times more than the United States of America, is that right?
Yeah, something more, 10 times more or something like that, went from Africa to Brazil than went to the United States of America. So exactly, isn't it interesting that when people have these conversations about and arguments and debates about the Atlantic slave trade, we think of it in terms of the Caribbean, of Jamaica, or we think of it in terms of the United States and this great southern cotton plantations. But Brazil is kind of left out of the story by English speakers because we know so little about it. So this nascent monarchy has been formed under Dom Pedro, who is the Portuguese king's son. And he is proclaimed the defender of Brazil, the emperor of Brazil. His proclamation of independence is very monarchist. He has a coronation, Tom, that you would very much appreciate.
Is it sacral?
It's very sacral. He is anointed.
Is it weird?
It is not weird. I know you've been some weeks ago, very unpatriotically, making comments about the weirdness of the...
It's not unpatriotic, Dominic. Weird is a perfectly respectable Old English word.
Well,
conveying a sense of the otherworldly and the supernatural.
You resorted to strange, abstruse linguistic
justifications
of your use of the word weird to describe the British monarchy, which I thought was absolutely disgraceful. And the 10-page Daily Mail denunciation is forthcoming. But in the meantime, while we're still doing the podcast together, while you are still allowed to travel the country and not yet confined to house arrest.
Enjoying the peace of good King Charles.
Exactly. We shall continue with Brazil. So he is anointed. Dom Pedro has a ceremony, which is based, I read, on the kind of enthroning of pontiffs and of emperors and so on. He's anointed and consecrated with holy oil.
But Brazil weird. Is kind of... Properly weird. Yeah.
It's completely reasonable and not weird at all.
Sacrifice.
Right. So this is a very conservative state in many ways. It's unlike other what you might call revolutionary independent states. It is devoted to the monarchy, to slavery, and to defending the interests of the big kind of Brazilian landowning classes, the people who own gold mines and sugar plantations and so on. And obviously that issue of slavery, because we're in the 19th century, means there is to some extent a kind of time bomb at the heart of the kind of Brazilian constitution. So about a third of the population are slaves. And in some areas, in Salvador, in the sort of northeast of Brazil, about 80% of the people in the city are slaves. Even in Rio, about 45% of the people, so about half the people there are slaves. So they are not kind of citizens. They are not members of the sort of political community of this new country.
So that seems equivalent of being for the slave owners to be the equivalent of camping out on the edge of a volcano.
You would think so, yeah. And we'll
how can if 80% of the population are slaves, are there revolts? Are there?
There are. I mean, spoiler alert: there will be slave revolts in this podcast. Yes, exactly. But the part that the monarchy plays in this slavery question is probably not the part that anybody is going to expect who doesn't know the story already. So we'll come to that. So what they're trying to do is to create a new nation. They have a state, but they don't really have a nation. So one way of doing that, they have a new flag. The flag of Brazil, everybody kind of green and yellow. The green, interestingly, so the flag of Brazil now is not quite the same as it was in the 1820s, but it's similar. So the green represents the House of Braganza, the Portuguese royal family.
I always thought it was the jungle.
No. And the yellow is the Austrian imperial family.
I always thought it was the gold.
No. God. So it's real old world kind of heraldry kind of stuff. There's a diamond shape in the flag, and that apparently is a tribute to Napoleon. I don't know why.
That seems counterintuitive.
Well,
Since they ran away there to get away from him.
I suppose so, but people are very transfixed by Napoleon, aren't they, at the beginning of the... Especially once he's been tamed and defeated.
Yeah, but we haven't got a reference to Napoleon on our flag.
I mean, it's interesting. No, that's true. But it's interesting that that Brazil is not a kingdom. It's an empire. So right from the beginning, there's a kind of ambition to the foundation of Brazil, that this is going to be a kind of Napoleonic empire in the Americas. And obviously, you don't just need a flag for a nation. You need a dynasty. So Dom Pedro, who is a very dissolute and useless person, really, who's only really interested in sort of his endless affairs with different kind of society women. I mean, we talked about him in our Portugal podcasts as having had chronic diarrhea when he was announcing.
Yes.
And that sort of sets the tone, I think, for his reign, I think it's fair to say. So, but he has a son in 1825, his wife, Donna Leopoldina. So she's from this sort of Austrian background, hence the flag. She gives birth to Dom Pedro, the future Dom Pedro II. And Dom Pedro II, who's going to dominate this podcast today, the little boy, he is related to almost every royal family in Europe. So he can trace his descent from the kings of Castile and Aragon, from the kings of France, from the kings of Hungary, from Maria Theresa of Austria. So this is a real, you know, he is a sort of an icon of European royalty born in the Americas. An extraordinary kind of individual. So he's the future of the dynasty. But his father, Dom Pedro I, useless. He's pretty much distracted. Yeah, yes, thank you for that, Tom. He is distracted pretty much straight away by Portugal because his father had died back in Portugal and he wants to be king of Portugal. So he's sort of increasingly torn between Portugal and Brazil. In 1831, the sort of tensions that underlie his rule. You know, is he content as Emperor of Brazil, or does he really ultimately want to go back to Portugal and claim the throne of Portugal? These come out in the open. There are a lot of liberals This is among the elite, the sort of elite in cities like Rio. People who are reading newspapers and kind of going to salons and things like that, who kind of chafe a little bit at the idea of an absolute monarch. They sort of take to the streets and they start sort of shouting, "Long live the Constitution," as people tend to do in the early years of the 19th century. There's a thing called the Night of the Bottles, where people are all throwing bottles at each other. Yeah, people are throwing bottles at each other. I assume empty bottles rather than, I mean, it seemed utterly wasteful to be throwing bottles of wine or something at
each
other.
Yeah, that'd be a waste, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be a terrible waste. And there's a sort of great groundswell of opinion against Don Pedro I. He says, right, I'm going to abdicate. So he abdicates.
And he flounces off to Portugal, does he?
And he flounces off to Portugal. So he abdicates. He says, my son is now the emperor, even though his son is five and a half.
Six? He's abdicated. That's very irresponsible.
Five and a half. He says, I'm off. I'm out of here. I'm going off to Portugal. So he does go off to Portugal. He fights a civil war in Portugal to try and put his daughter on the throne of Portugal.
So what's his plan?
He's going to be the power behind the throne. The Portuguese have made it clear they don't want him as king, but he thinks, I'll put my daughter on the throne and I'll be the big man. He dies of tuberculosis in the hour of his victory, Tom.
Oh, that's sad.
But interestingly, here's the thing. Here's a sort of portent of the future. Don Pedro I, who we described as useless, on his deathbed, he writes an open letter to the people of Brazil. So he hasn't forgotten about Brazil, which is nice.
Oh, okay, that's good.
And in the open letter, he says, slavery is an evil and an attack against the rights and dignity of the human species, but its consequences are less harmful to those who suffer in captivity than to the nation whose laws allow slavery. It is a cancer that devours its morality. So he's sort of pinning his, saying, you know, the monarchy should not be in favor of slavery, and slavery is very bad.
Well, I'm sure the slaves are happy about that, but I'm not entirely sure they'd agree with him that they're better off than their owners.
Yes, exactly. That's right.
Who's the real victim here?
Exactly. So anyway, Dom Pedro I is dead. Meanwhile, back in Brazil, the Brazilians are having to get used to their second emperor, who is not yet 6 years old. So poor little Dom Pedro II, they bring him onto a balcony in Rio. He's so small, he can't kind of look over the balustrade. So they put him on a chair and he waves a hanky. They get him to wave a hanky to the crowds and everybody cheers and says, hurrah, hurrah, hurrah. But for him, this is very bad news. He's sent off to a palace called São Cristóvão with his two sisters, Francisca and Januária. January.
Great name.
Great name. And they basically are just sort of locked in this palace and given endless lessons. Mm-hmm. So the Brazilians think it's very important that their future emperor, well, their current emperor, I suppose.
And what are they teaching him? Lepidoptery.
They teach him. Well, we know because we have a letter.
Botany.
There are very few sources, actually, Tom, on the life of poor Dom Pedro II, because he's locked in his room the whole time, so we don't really know. But he writes a letter to his sister at one point, and he's in 1833, and he says, writing, arithmetic, geography, drawing, French, English, music, and dance divide our time. We work constantly to acquire knowledge, and it is only these efforts that mitigate how sorely we miss you during our separation.
Oh.
So he's not really allowed any friends.
So he's not really learning about rainforests or anything?
No. He's learning European, old world sort of stuff. Hmm. So he's sort of locked in his room doing arithmetic all the time. He's pretty miserable. He's pretty unhappy. He's lonely. He's been separated from his parents. He's kind of shy and he's reclusive. So there's the emperor. He's the little boy who's the emperor of Brazil. Meanwhile, Brazil itself is a bit of I won't call it a basket case, that's too harsh, but you asked about slave revolts. There are an awful lot of slave revolts in the early decades of Brazilian independence. So in the state of Pernambuco, there's a big revolt called the Cabanada Revolt. And that's, you've got Brazilian Indians, escaped slaves, squatters, people who've sort of been marginalized and forced out. They all come together and they form their own kind of community in the woods. And they form their own army and they're always fighting off the landowners' attempts to kind of put them down. And this is a real theme of 19th century Brazilian history.
And how long did they manage to hold out?
They held out for about 4 years. I mean, quite a long time.
Yeah.
And this is absolutely you see this pattern again and again. So in the big, huge northern state of Pará in the late 1830s, there's another revolt of, again, sort of Indians, slaves, and so on. And their slaves turn against their masters and they whip them and kill them. And in the cities, there are huge sort of outpourings of hatred against the slaves and the Indians. And people say they're evil, they're the forces of the devil. You know, this is what happened in Haiti, the Haitian Revolution. That will happen here in Brazil. The only way to deal with them is by, you know, intense violence and so on and so forth. And there is a colossal amount of violence. So in states like Para, I mean, I think something like 100,000 people were killed. I mean, these are massive, you know, death tolls. Yeah. I was about to say utterly unreported in the old world. That's not really true. But what is true, I suppose, is that they're utterly forgotten today. And so in Europe, people aren't even aware that these things happened.
Well, presumably they are in Portugal.
Yeah, I'm sure people know about it in Portugal. But
I mean, we know about American history because we speak English. So,
right, I suppose that's true.
I mean, that's the reason.
A slave revolt that would really interest you is in the sort of northeastern state of Bahia in 1835, famous city there, which was a huge sort of trading sort of center for the slave trade, Salvador. So there, there's an Islamic element to the slave revolt.
That's unexpected.
So a lot of the African slaves who are being brought to Bahia are Muslims. And Islam becomes the kind of the common ground for different groups of slaves so they can unite around their faith. So they wear white tunics, white prayer tunics. They wear amulets inscribed with verses from the Quran when they rise up. And of course, that then means that for the slave owners,
it's a religious war.
It's a religious war. Exactly. So again, extremely violent. When that's put down, 500 people are publicly executed.
Are there traces of Islam still in Salvador?
That's a good question, Tom. I don't know. I don't know at all. Of course, the big story in Brazil has been the rise of Protestant evangelicalism.
Yes.
So originally a Catholic country, but...
I just wondered whether...
But I don't know. I'd be interested to find out, actually. Maybe so if we have Brazilian listeners. I don't think we ultimately do have many Brazilian listeners, but we do have a few, Tom, because we put out our Brazilian independence episode.
Yes, we did.
So the story about the Portuguese court on Brazil's Independence Day. And we had some listeners saying it was actually a complete coincidence, wasn't it? But we pretended it was by design and our Brazilian listeners were very, very excited. So there's a real sense at the end of the 1830s, anyway, that Brazil is a bit of a sort of, it's in a terrible ferment with all this sort of stuff. And the elites decide the way to deal with this is actually we need to crown the emperor, even though he's still only a teenager. If we put him in charge, he will be a figure around whom everybody can kind of rally. So it's 1841, and he is what? He's about to turn 16. And they have this huge coronation ceremony in Rio. All the newspapers sort of say he is the greatest man of his generation. He is the new, you know, Charles V or whatever. He is a master of languages and of education, all this stuff, because basically he's been locked in a schoolroom for all his life. So all this sort of projection of him is the answer to all Brazil's woes. They have this, it's interesting how they're still so kind of enthralled to European models. So they have huge medallions, four medallions for his models, Tom, and the people who he's going to emulate. And they are Charlemagne, François I of France, so Henry VIII's great rival, Napoleon, and sometime friend, sometime associate of the rest is history, Peter the Great. These are the people that, what do you think of that?
Well, I think there'd be a lot of roistering. But he doesn't sound the kind of roistering kind, does he?
No,
I mean, he's François Premier and Peter the Great, both they love throwing a dwarf around and
they're great
smashing
wrestlers.
Up a garden.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wheelbarrow races and all that kind of
Charlemagne?
Stuff. Charlemagne, he liked a hot bath.
And very,
he'd hang out in the bath and chat to churchmen. So I don't know.
I was about to say, chatting to churchmen is his thing, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
And who is the other person?
Napoleon.
Well, we metric
know
system.
About Napoleon.
Yeah, metric system.
Is that what first comes into your mind when you think Napoleon? The metric system.
what should
you
I
write,
think of?
You write for the Daily Mail.
What should I? Well, but I mean, the metric system is surely the greatest of Napoleon's horrors.
The greatest evil.
Tom, you're right. Talking to a man who once wrote a column saying that the adoption of decimal currency was the moment Britain lost its national soul. So yeah,
okay. Okay, well, I can see that why that's a shadow yeah. hanging over you. All right, so to what extent does he live up to these four role models?
Do you know what? He doesn't do too badly. Now, there is one, he needs a wife, so...
Because he's not a milksop.
Not a total milksop. No, well, you shall discover that he's not a total milksop. They bring over a wife for him 2 years after he's been crowned. She's Princess Teresa Maria Cristina of the Two Sicilies.
Great stuff.
She comes over. He's been told, it's very Anne of Cleves. He has been told she's an absolute beauty. You know, God, you're going to be over the moon. You can't wait. She arrives. She's quite short. She's quite large. And she's lame. And it is said that he composed himself. He was sufficiently composed not to disgrace himself when she was brought in. But when she went out again, he burst into tears.
Oh.
And
well, sad for both of them.
And his sort of major domo embraced him and kind of consoled him and said, remember the dignity of your position. Do your duty, my child.
And does he?
And he did do his duty, actually.
So
he did do his duty.
He's
very unlucky because all his sons died very young. But he was left with an heir, a daughter called Isabel, who we will come to later on. So Dom Pedro II, he's a kind of constitutional monarch. He's got more power than in Britain, but obviously he's not got the power of a czar or sort of Louis the 14th or something like that. I suppose the big sort of pressure is this issue of slavery. So just to give you a sense of slavery in Brazil, slavery is so embedded in the Brazilian social structure that Rio de Janeiro in, let's say, 1850 has more slaves than any city, supposedly, since the end of the Roman Empire. That's an amazing statistic.
That is amazing,
Tom.
Fact.
So 110,000 slaves live in
Rio de Janeiro?
More than Baghdad? Apparently so. I mean, I don't compile these mysterious facts that I find on the internet, so I'm not. I think actually I read this. There's a brilliant book called Brazil, A Biography by Eloisa Starling and Lilia Moritz Schwartz, which I talked about in our Portuguese episode.
Yes,
it's the definitive English language history, I think, of Brazil, a sort of academic history of Brazil. And it's absolutely brilliant on this sort of the world of Rio in the mid-19th century. So to give you a sort of sense of it, it's not just that... former slaves own slaves, but actual slaves own slaves.
That was a Roman thing.
Did Roman slaves own slaves?
Yeah.
Well, this is what they have in Brazil. I mean, it's so embedded.
Well, it's Latin America.
Right. We're Latin America. Very good. That obviously is coming under pressure because the British are moving internationally against the slave trade, for example. And there's a move within Brazil to encourage immigration rather than slavery. So in the mid-19th century, you're starting to get the government encouraging lots of massive immigration of sort of cheap labor from Europe as an alternative to the slave trade. But so that is going to create all kinds of pressures of its own. And those are some of the things that Dom Pedro is going to have to wrestle with now that he has really taken the reins of his country.
So should we look at his wrestling with the reins of his country?
Yeah.
In part two.
Is that a good image, wrestling with the reins?
Quite like
it. I mean,
it's
better than wrestling with dwarves like Peter the Great or something.
Yeah. So when we come back, there'll be a rein wrestling. So something to look forward to there.
That's exciting.
Bye-bye. Hello, welcome back to our Brazil special. We're looking at the reign of Emperor Pedro II of Brazil. And Dominic, in the first part, we briefly, you touched on a slave revolt in which, in Salvador, in North Brazil, where lots of the slaves were Muslim. And I asked you, does Islam still have much of a presence in Brazil? And during the break, I went to the Bodleian and I checked. And you know, out of a population of 191 million, the total number of Muslims in Brazil, 35,000.
Crikey.
So very, very small, under
1%. Tiny.
Yeah, very, really tiny. And apparently the Muslims that took part in this the slave revolts were very aggressively proselytized. So they were essentially forcibly converted to Catholicism. And so
crikey.
So the trace elements of Islam were wiped out. And the Muslims now are basically immigrants from Lebanon and Syria.
Yeah. So that tells you something about the violence of the system, right? That
yes,
they're
it
able
does.
To suppress the slaves' religion so completely. Yes, yeah, so Pedro II, what he really wants to do is to create a unique Brazilian national culture. And it's under his aegis that he encourages all kinds of Brazilian writers and painters and so on to create a kind of idea of Brazilianness. And what it's going to be is slavery is not part of the story at all. So what he does is he kind of creates this idea of a specifically kind of tropical culture full of images of Indians and things and of the Portuguese, but the slaves are almost entirely absent. So paintings, they do lots of landscapes and lots of kind of very romantic.
And is it now that they're starting to wake up to the grandeur of the natural world on their doorstep?
Yes. So the natural world is, you asked at the beginning about him and the natural world, and the natural world is very much his thing.
So now they're getting to jaguars and things.
Exactly. So the imagery is all kind of, you know, exotic fruits and exotic beasts. You see these in lots of Brazilian kind of landscape paintings. He himself, he's very much a sort of bookish person. So he starts to learn. He loves languages. He's kind of like sort of J.R.R. Tolkien figure, studying languages.
Finnish grammars.
But he's not studying Finnish grammars. He's studying Tupi and Guarani. So indigenous Indian, Brazilian Indian languages, which other people in the elite regard with scorn, but the emperor is really interested in all this sort of stuff. He finances all kinds of research projects. He brings over German botanists and sort of Swedish naturalists and mineralogists and linguists and geologists from all over Europe. And he basically pays for them to come to Brazil and to produce these beautifully illustrated.
But so this isn't something completely new, is it? Because there's that, the very famous and beautiful library that burnt down, I think, 4 years ago, something like that, which I think dates to the kind of the early years of the arrival of the Portuguese family, royal family in Brazil.
They have beautiful libraries in Portugal, actually, Tom. Amazing.
Yes, so that's very much, in the tradition.
Yeah.
And it was I think it's where the Brazilian emperor stayed. So that tradition of that library and that kind of tradition of scholarship and interest in the natural world to a degree is something that he must be picking up on from that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what's really interesting is that what he's trying to do is he's trying to reproduce the old world in the new. I mean, not quite. He's giving it this spin, this sort of tropical culture and this tropical monarchy. But he's obviously very, you know, it's very important to Dom Pedro II that he creates a Brazilian culture that people will consider alongside, you know, Portuguese, Spanish, French, German, Italian culture or whatever, that it's part of the same kind of continuum, I guess. And science, he's absolutely passionate about science. He's the first Brazilian photographer because he acquires a kind of very early daguerreotype camera in 1840. He sets up a photo laboratory in his palace in São Cristóvão. He also has a chemistry laboratory and a physics laboratory. He has an astronomical observatory. He has a saying that he likes to bring out and bore his courtiers with. He says, "La science, c'est moi."
Well, Dominic, I'm just reading in the Bodleian that he apparently there was a meteorite that landed in the Badlands, and he sent an expedition to try and find it.
That's exactly the kind of thing he did.
It was a 5 metric ton space rock.
Wow! Did they get it?
So it landed in 1784, and so when Pedro II learned about the meteorite, he organized a commission of engineers to relocate it to Rio, and the trek lasted 126 days, and it was taken to the National Museum, the one with the library. So,
twiky.
There you go. And I'm glad to say that meteorite was among the objects that were left unscathed by the fire that destroyed the museum. So it survived.
Tom.
So that's good news.
As somebody who likes science, dinosaurs, all that kind of business, you would love Dom Pedro II.
He sounds great, great guy.
He's a man of...
I tell you what he sounds like. He sounds an absolutely ideal subject to be the hero of a magical realist novel.
Yeah, he absolutely is. He absolutely is. So he's very into literature as well. He writes to people like Victor Hugo, to Nietzsche, to Wagner, to all these people. You know, they think he's brilliant. So his reputation in Europe among the sort of European lettered classes could not be higher. He asked Wagner to write an opera that would be premiered in Rio.
So would you say he is the Pelé of
cultured
European monarchs?
Very nice. Yes. He's the Pelé and rather than the Neymar of European style American monarchs, right. I think it's fair to say. So yeah, he asked Wagner to write an opera. Wagner was too busy, so he couldn't. However, supposedly when they did the whole Ring cycle at Bayreuth in 1876, Don Pedro II was present. We should come on to his European travels in due course. And he sat next to the new emperor of Germany, the premier. So this is not the Kaiser, Tom, friend of the rest is history, great yachting enthusiast and shoe wearer. It's his grandfather, Kaiser Wilhelm I. And Don Pedro ruins the opera for everybody by constantly saying to all the other bigwigs, he says, oh, I'm very familiar with this music. This is the first time you've heard it, but I know it by heart. I know all about this. You don't need to tell me anything about Wagner. I know Wagner. I love Wagner. Wagner's my friend and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which drives everybody else completely, completely mad. So in other words, his reputation is sky high. Brazil itself, they fight a terrible, incredibly bloody war called the War of the Triple Alliance in Paraguay in the 1860s, which apart from being bloody, it's very useful for Brazil because it creates this sort of image of Brazilian nationalism and of the sort of united fatherland and all this sort of stuff. But obviously there is this issue of slavery. Now, let's get to the 1870s. Brazil has about 10 million people by now, and between 10 and 20% of them, I think, are slaves. But the sort of the epicenter of slavery has slightly moved, because what's change with Brazil is before we were talking about gold and we're talking about the mining, but the big thing in Brazil now is coffee. So coffee is produced in the south of Brazil, and that's where the sort of the epicenter of slavery has really moved to. The big landowners are based in the south around Rio and Sao Paulo, and in the four southernmost provinces, about just under two-thirds of the population are slaves. Now, the emperor himself, Dom Pedro II personally, is not in favor of slavery at all. He never bought slaves. He inherited 40 slaves and he set them all free as soon as he could. He would often write to friends and he would say he doesn't like slavery. Slavery is a terrible curse on my nation, he would say. But he was always inhibited from moving against it because he's worried about alienating the elite. He thinks the elite who own the slaves, he depends on them for his power. So Brazil is sort of slowly beginning to change. So they do things like there's a law of free birth in 1871, which is that basically all children of slaves will be freed. They have to stay with their mothers until they're eight. And then their owners, the mother's owner, can choose between being compensated by the state then and there, and the child is set free at the age of eight, or they can continue to use the child's services until the child turns 21. So this is hardly, you know, kind of overnight abolition. But even so, it begins to alienate the big kind of coffee elites, the slave owners, because they start to think, well, if the government can do this, the monarch is not to be trusted. The monarch is going to end up abolishing slavery completely. This is all a very bad thing. So what you get in the 1870s is something that I think a lot of listeners may find a bit weird, which is that the what you'd call the kind of liberal elite, i.e. the people who read newspapers, who go to the opera, who, you know, are sophisticated, you know, people of the world, people who are well-traveled, these people start to flirt with republicanism and become interested in republicanism because they equate republicanism with the defense of slavery. So in other words, something that you might think of as very progressive becomes identified with a cause that could hardly be more reactionary. So there's this sort of sense in the 1870s that for all his amazing scientific stuff, interfering with meteorites.
Sourcing and yeah.
Yeah, being a fan of Wagner, all this kind of stuff, that the emperor is losing support among the very people that he really most needs to keep his regime going.
But do the slaves not love him?
Well, yeah, the slaves do, as we'll discover, the slaves do quite like the emperor because they see him as the sort of face of the abolitionist movement, which is perhaps a slight misreading of it because he doesn't really do that much to encourage abolition. But so you start to get mockery of Pedro II. People, they have some very strange names for him, actually. His opponents call him Pedro Banana.
Why? Seems very harsh.
Well, I say his head is very long. He has a very long head.
He looks like a banana. Right, okay.
Maybe his sort of Habsburg blood or something like that.
Yeah.
They also
they used to call Pericles the squid.
The squid. They also call him Pedro the cashew. Would you rather be a cashew or a banana, Tom?
I think cashew.
I think a cashew as well. I think I'd much rather be likened to a cashew. I think a banana is just undecorous, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you're going to be likened to a fruit of any kind. Louis Philippe in France was likened to a pear.
Yeah. And Chiang Kai-shek was likened to a peanut, wasn't he?
Was he?
By General Sitwell.
Oh, yes, of course he was. Yes, he used to call him a peanut. Yeah. So but there's a whole podcast to be done about emperors and
fruit and nut-based abuse is it's a real theme there. That we can perhaps run with a bit later
it
on.
It definitely is.
Yeah.
So the elites, the sort of liberal elites, think that Don Pedro is unsound on slavery. They also think he's unsound on travel. Because in the 1870s, he starts to go traveling a lot, and they think this is very bad and very unpatriotic, and he should be more interested in Brazil. But he keeps sort of going for these jaunts around Europe. So he goes to America. So, Tom, would you believe he is the first ruling monarch to set foot in the United States?
But not the first to set foot in North America, because Maximilian of Mexico, who we did a whole episode on, didn't we?
We did. So when Ulysses S. Grant opens the World's Fair in Philadelphia in 1876, Don Pedro II is standing by his side. I mean, the World's Fair, he loves all that. Science, machines, displays of botany.
International travel,
exactly. He goes to visit Alexander Graham Bell and allows him to test his first telephone, which is very nice. Hola. He then goes off to France. He goes to visit Victor Hugo. He visits Victor Hugo at his house. There's a lovely story here, Tom. Victor Hugo's daughter shows him in and says, Papa, here is His Majesty from Brazil. And do you know what Don Pedro II says? My dear, there is only one Majesty here, and it is Victor Hugo.
Oh, that's splendid.
Isn't that good? And Victor Hugo says...
No, I really like him. He sources meteorites and he's polite to great French novelists.
He is. Victor Hugo said to him, Sire, you are a great man. You are the grandson of Marcus Aurelius. Oh, isn't that a nice thing to hear?
Yeah, fabulous.
Everything. I mean, this is all very good. All very, very, very good. However,
I hope it doesn't go wrong.
It's going to end badly, Tom. Oh, I'll tell you now. I just wanted... I don't want it to come as too much as a shock when Don Pedro's life ends in misery, as it will.
No. Oh.
So he gets back to Brazil, and the Brazilians, you know, they're very displeased by all this behavior. They say, by this stage, he's grown a massive beard. He's got glasses. He doesn't look... They're sort of puffed up, I think, a little bit with a sense of sort of national destiny. And they think he is an unprepossessing monarch. He's too interested in books and science and stuff. And he's unsound, as they think, on slavery, on the defense of slavery. And so they're sort of losing enthusiasm for him. A few years go by. 1887, he goes on another of his trips. So he goes, this time he goes and visits Louis Pasteur, do you believe? And he spends a lot of time in Europe. He often goes under an assumed name when he's traveling Europe, so he doesn't go as the emperor. So I think the Brazilians also think this is poor form. They would like him to go in splendor, whereas in fact, he goes and stays in hotels under false names and spends his time writing poems. And they basically think this is, and also it's known that he's basically said to people, I love doing this. Left to me, I would just do this all the time. I'd much rather live in Europe than in Brazil and hang around with Victor Hugo. So meanwhile, while he's away, obviously the issue of slavery is still there. Slavery has been abolished in the United States since the 1860s. We're now in the 1880s. There's a real sense that it's on its last legs, not least because the age of mass immigration means that the Brazilian economy is not as dependent on slavery as it once was. There are rising slave revolts in the 1880s, and eventually, basically, the Brazilian government passes a law overnight, May 1888. The remaining 700,000 slaves are emancipated kind of forthwith. So, end of slavery. Now, the people who are really outraged about this are the coffee planters, the coffee elites of Rio and Sao Paulo. As far as they're concerned, they've lost their property. They blame the emperor. Actually, he's out of the country when it happens because he's on one of his tours.
He's hanging out with Louis Pasteur.
Right. But they say it's all his fault. He hasn't stuck up for us. He's a waste of space. He's got to go. There's also this huge thing in Brazil of positivism. You know, the sort of the late 19th century kind of the idea of science and reform and all that kind of thing. That has a massive traction with the kind of Brazil, the Brazilian educated classes. I guess because it's about anti-clericalism. Mm-hmm. So
this turns against the idea of emperors, does it?
Against the idea of emperors, that kind of positivism, republicanism, secularism, this sort of beautiful new future, which just so neatly, you know, happens to align
with
their own
interests. Yeah.
For their interests, exactly. So there's all this sort of stuff about the positivism and the republicanism. They're all kind of meetings and conspiracies. He gets back to Brazil. And in 1889, on the 9th of November, 1889, he has a ball called the Ball on Fiscal Island. So this is a particular island. And he goes, it's basically to welcome the Chilean Navy who are visiting Brazil. And he goes to this ball, and there are all kinds of rumors going around the city about this ball, that there are orgies happening, that he hasn't invited sufficient numbers of bigwigs, of sort of liberal-minded bigwigs and so on. And while he's at the ball, the sort of Republican agitators have a meeting with officers in the Brazilian army. The Brazilian army, and this is a very bizarre thing to say about an army, the Brazilian army is a hotbed of positivism, Tom. The officers like nothing better than of an evening chatting about positivist ideas they've got from Europe. So they basically, a whole load of young officers go to this old marshal who's called Deodoro de Fonseca. They go to his house and they say, you know, the cause of positivism and of Brazil, it's time to get rid of the emperor. This old fool is at his party. We should move against him. The marshal, Deodoro de Fonseca, he sort of drags his heels a bit, but eventually agrees to do it. So 5 days later, on the 14th of November, he rides to the army headquarters. It's all a bit confused. He proclaims this coup against the emperor with the words, "Long live His Majesty the Emperor, the Imperial Family, and the Army," which is obviously not the ideal launch for a Republican coup. But nevertheless, he says the government's got to go. We have a new regime and all this kind of stuff. The emperor is up in his palace and he's sort of, you know, thinking about meteorites. He gets a telegram from the center of Rio saying there's been some kind of coup. And he says to his wife, "Oh, it's fine." He says, "I'll go down to Rio, but when I arrive there, it'll all be over. It's just a storm in a teacup." He travels by train. And on the train, Tom, you'll be delighted to hear, he spends his time on the train. He takes it so seriously. He spends his time reading the latest scientific periodicals. So he gets to the center of Rio. And various sort of marquises and stuff present themselves and they say, "Should we raise troops to suppress this coup?" The emperor says, no, I know that this is nothing. I know the people of Brazil. This is absolutely nothing. Then eventually a load of officers pitch up at the palace, somewhere on the 16th of November, and they say, "Actually, it is something. We've decided that you and the rest of the imperial family should be banished." Now, this is by no means, we're talking about quite small groups of people. This is by no means a mass uprising. It's not like this isn't the French Revolution. There are no kind of great mobs pouring through the streets because the emperor is actually pretty popular. But the emperor, I think partly because there's part of him that thinks this basically means a lot of time I can spend with Louis Pasteur. When they tell him this, he says, "If it is so, then this will be my retirement. I've worked hard and I'm tired. It is time to go and rest." And so, unbelievably, without raising an army to defend himself or anything like this, he says, "Right, let's pack our bags." In fact, the only time he kind of gets angry is when the officers come back in a day later and they say, basically, have you not packed yet? You've got to go now in the middle of the night. And the emperor is very cross and he shouts at them and he says, "I am not an escaped slave. I will not leave in the middle of the night." And then he shouts, "All of you are mad." But then he packs his bags anyway and he gets on the boat and off he goes to Europe. And that's basically the end of him.
And that's it. So he doesn't come to a terrible end. Actually, it's quite a happy story because he said he was.
I think it's a disappointing end, Tom. He'd been good for Brazil.
I thought he was going to have a horrible end in a dungeon or something. Like
no, he doesn't have an end in a dungeon.
I'm happy about that. And what happens to his daughter?
Well, she goes with him. Actually, she never wanted to be empress. And he didn't even want her to be empress either.
Then. This is a happy story.
Except he doesn't live very well. We'll come on to what happens to him. So this is 1889. I'll quote a Brazilian writer about what happened next to Brazil. So in the century after they got rid of Emperor Dom Pedro II, the Brazilian Republic had 12 states of emergency, 17 institutional acts. The National Congress dissolved six times, 19 military revolutions, two presidential resignations, three presidents prevented from assuming office, four presidents deposed, seven different constitutions, four dictatorships, and nine authoritarian governments. So I think it's fair to say Dom Pedro II was a relative oasis of stability. And in fact, you ask about the slaves and what the slaves thought of him. He was very popular among Brazil's kind of African population and Indian population. Exactly. So we did a podcast, what seems like an eternity ago, about weird wars. And one of the weird wars, one of my choices was a war called the War of Canudos in the 1890s, written about in a brilliant book called The War at the End of the World by Mario Vargas Llosa, the Peruvian novelist. And this was a kind of, there was a guy called Antonio the Counselor who led this kind of weird kind of religious commune. And that appealed to former slaves. And there were thousands of them. And they fought this war in which 30,000 people died against the Brazilian government. And part of the appeal of his kind of commune and his millenarian religious movement was that an emperor, a king, would return. So it was a combination of Dom Pedro II and the lost king of Portugal, Dom Sebastião, from the 16th century. And this Dom Pedro II lived on in the memory of lots of Brazilians as this kind of exiled enlightenment paragon.
King over the water.
Yeah, the king over the water who had presided over abolition.
So what happened to him?
So he went off to Europe. It wasn't a great laugh, actually. He didn't hang out as much as he would have liked with scientists and novices because he's in very poor health. He suffered from what I think diabetes. Most people think he now had diabetes. He didn't have much money because the Brazilians basically cut off all his money. So he lived for only 2 years in Europe. So this sort of dream of a lovely retirement.
Oh, that's sad.
However, when he died in Paris, which he loved, of pneumonia in December 1891, the French, to their they're very good with dead monarchs, Tom. Aren't they the French? President Macron absolutely distinguished himself.
Yes, he did.
Not always a friend of the rest is history.
Yeah.
But he distinguished himself with his reaction to the death of the Queen. So the French stage a state funeral for Dom Pedro II, where his coffin was escorted by 30,000 French troops. 30,000!
Goodness.
And 300,000 people stood in the pouring rain to see it go.
Well, the French do love a monarch, don't they?
They love this. There are hundreds of wreaths, and the message on the wreath that stands out, there was one wreath that said simply, "From a Brazilian black on behalf of his race," which sort of tells you about how. So then he was his coffin was taken by train to Portugal, and he was buried alongside the other Braganza monarchs.
Because he didn't go back to Brazil.
To Brazil. But interestingly, he is pretty much regarded, I think, by a lot of ordinary Brazilians as the greatest Brazilian. So he wins polls and things like that.
Did they have an equivalent of the?
I don't think they did.
The one that Salazar won in Portugal.
We often talk about that. Did they have? I don't think they did in Brazil. I might be wrong.
So there's no kind of imperial party in Brazil saying let's bring back the emperor.
But I think I think Brazil is a fascinating country. Obviously, a great footballing history, but it'd be even more fascinating if it was an empire again. Don't you think, Tom?
Yeah.
I mean, at the moment, I'm going to pin my colours. Can I pin my colours to the mask?
Yeah.
I'm not a massive admirer of Bolsonaro.
No.
In fact, I think I'd go as far as to say he's not a friend of the rest of his history.
What about President Lula?
He's got a great name.
Because he was in prison, wasn't he?
And now he was in prison. Of the two, I would pick Lula, I'll be honest with you.
But given the choice of Lula, Bolsonaro, or
Dom Pedro II,
an emperor with an interest in meteorites, who would you go for?
I'd go for the emperor. Well, I always, I'm a monarchy fan. An emperor who like stages operas and gives money to historical associations.
I think he'd be very into dinosaurs as well.
Is he a friend of the rest of his history? I'd like to think he is.
Yeah. Let's enshrine him as a friend of the rest of history.
Great.
Okay. Well, that's wonderful.
No higher honor.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I knew nothing about him at all. Nothing. So I really feel that I've educated myself here.
You've gained a friend, I think it's fair to say.
I've gained knowledge and I've gained a friend.
Oh, that's lovely.
That is, you know, that can't be reckoned a waste of time. So
podcast is a waste of time, I'll be very shocked.
I hope that everyone listening likewise has gained a friend perhaps in the form of Don Pedro and has maybe you learned something as I have done. So thank you all very much for listening. Thank you, Dominic, for, dare I call it a tour de force?
I think you should.
I think I will. A tour de force. Yeah. So thank you very much. Thank you all for listening. And we will be back very, very soon with more. Bye-bye.
Adios.